now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
In a rebirth of biblical proportions, the environmental movement transmuted into a powerful, positive message of hope, health, and prosperity. As nations around the world continue to fight the old wars over old ideas, a whole new global society is forging ahead with hands wide open for a working alliance amongst the enlightened new leaders of the new free world. Passions are rising. Alliances of all sorts are changing the world. Get ready to hop on a hope-bound flight to wonder when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
A few weeks back, the Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News took an in-depth look at whether environmentalism was dead. Well, today, I have to laugh, because something is changing, and perhaps that tough look made a difference. What's amazing is that this thing that we call environmentalism is taking on a whole new refurbished image, no longer associated with old politics. The newly enlightened Earth Alliance is here. We hear each day the old captains of the old guard, old industries, as they try to make sense out of the ancient old wars between ancient old nations over crumbling ideas and dying visions. Is Iraq the last bastion of the old guard? The oil wars for old energy are getting really old. I'm intrigued by the new energy wars that we hear being launched each day. The battle pits some old players in a new struggle to outproduce and undercut each other in the production of affordable, renewable energy. As the battle rages, who are the victors? Us. It's a new day as good old competition starts battling to produce the cheapest, safest energy, because those who succeed will become phenomenally wealthy. Hooray for us. In a moment, I will bring you the news which will bring to light reports from the front lines of the new energy wars. And following the news, we turn our attention to a love story for the Earth. It centers on a legendary Shakespearean actress and film star who meets a wild-spirited biologist who brought the songs of the humpback whales to our awareness. Married, still creating and researching, Lisa Harrow and Roger Payne join us from their home in Woodstock, Vermont. You will love this private excursion into the private passions of two of the world's great creative geniuses. This is a special extended edition of the Wild Side News. So settle back and get ready for another great adventure. But first, the news. This week, the new energy wars were launched. A day after Governor Schwarzenegger's Million Solar Roofs initiative was announced, Germany's top solar energy policymaker, Dr. Hermann Scheer, commended the governor for engaging in the new battle. In a statement, Dr. Scheer announced, "In Germany, we have found that solar power is beneficial to our overall economy, bringing new industry, jobs, and stable electric rates. I strongly encourage California to make a similar commitment to solar power as Germany and Japan. With the amount of annual sunshine and rapid economic growth, California would easily become the global leader in the solar industry." Meanwhile, the Chinese top legislature voted to pass China's first renewable energy promotion law, which will help the country meet ambitious targets for renewable energy. Greenpeace International's Steve Sawyer stated, "China could and should be a world leader in renewable energy development. The international community will get behind China and support its ambition to become an international clean energy powerhouse." As Germany and Japan forge ahead, the war is engaged to see who will win. We hope to announce the winner in the very near future. Bets are on that the winner may be us. On the old war front, the Senate is preparing to shut down over the attempt by Senate Republicans to attach the bill authorizing drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil and gas to a budget measure. Republican leaders indicated Tuesday that they plan to press the issue of drilling as part of a so-called budget reconciliation process, which cannot be subject to a Democratic filibuster. As this bill is one of President Bush's top energy priorities, every attempt is being made to get the job done. Good old Republican Senator Pete Domenici, chairman of the Energy Committee and a strong supporter of refuge oil development, said he was very optimistic we're going to get the ANWR provision in this budget. Meanwhile, ConocoPhillips and BP have pulled out of Arctic Power, a pro-drilling lobbying group financed by the state of Alaska. Chevron Texaco left the group earlier. Interior Secretary Gail Norton downplayed these developments and said she is confident oil companies will be found to bid on the leases. She characterized the need to drill ANWR for oil as a national security issue. And speaking of Gail Norton, the BLM has reversed a 34-year-old ban on the slaughter of wild horses that run free in the West. The legislation was passed removing the slaughter ban when Senator Conrad Burns, Republican from Montana, attached the amendment to a spending bill that President Bush signed into law. We will bring you timely updates on the new energy wars being waged as the new National Security Alliance struggles to win the war for energy independence. And that's the news. And now, a few announcements. Next week, we bring you the Apollo Alliance, in depth. And on March 24th, we talk with New York Times bestselling author John Perkins, whose book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is sending shockwaves around the world as he reveals the underside of development and the effects such has had and is having on the living systems around the world. And please, send me your emails with your ideas, thoughts, and join the Voice of the Earth family of friends. I thank you all for listening. Our numbers are growing each week. Hey, invite your friends to come along. And now, we turn our attention to our special edition of the Voice of the Earth. In 1991, at a Greenpeace rally to save the whales, noted whale biologist Dr. Roger Payne was speaking about whales, something he knows a lot about, as he was co-discoverer of the wondrous knowledge that humpback whales sing. His album, Songs of the Humpback Whales, had changed the way the world thought about these magnificent creatures. Also speaking at the event was the Royal Shakespearean actress and actress Lisa Harrell, who too was making an appeal on behalf of the world's whales. Two stars whose orbits touch, a contact. 10 weeks later, they were married. Today we talk with Lisa Harrell and Dr. Roger Payne about their work now as a team. Lessons from Copernicus, a performance piece crafted and performed by the two, brings science and poetry into the creative crucible to work the ancient magic of the theater to change our world. It's a modern mystery play. Lisa and Roger talk about their ongoing work. Lisa about her new book, What Can I Do? An Alphabet for Living, created from her passion to give us all answers we need to make a difference. And Roger talks about the voyage of the Odyssey, his oceanic journey of discovery, now in its fifth and final year, and featured on PBS. And they perform a piece from Lessons from Copernicus. In this, a Voice of the Earth special edition of the Wild Side News, we stretch the boundaries and broadcast for an hour and a half. It's a fascinating journey with two of the Earth's finest magicians. Come along and let them work their magic on you. Now I have the great pleasure of talking with an extraordinary human being in many respects, Lisa Harrell. She certainly is a well-known actress. She is a Shakespearean actress as well and has worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And she's talking to us from her home, which is in Woodstock, Vermont. Lisa, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you, Sydney. I'm pleased to be here.
Now, somehow you're ending up being a major voice in trying to help save this planet. And let's find out, how did this begin for you?
Well, it began in my childhood in New Zealand, although, because I grew up in New Zealand, and although I wasn't necessarily concerned in terms of being a member of any movement, my father, who is a scientist, kept saying, you know, population, world population, that's all very well, but, you know, your generation, all you can think of is that the world owes me a living, but the population problem is going to get in the way of all of you and you'll have huge problems. And we all used to look at him and laugh when we were young. Well, of course, he was right. And then I came to England and I was there for many years working as an actress. And And in 1991, I went to a Greenpeace rally for whales in Trafalgar Square. I was invited to be one of a group of celebrity speakers. And I was given a piece to talk about long-range communication of whales across oceans and across many, many, many thousands of miles. And I was astonished at that because I had no idea that whales could do all these things. I, unlike a lot of people, had never heard the whale record, and because I think I was too busy doing Shakespeare or something at the time. But anyway, Roger Payne opened this rally for whales, and we met there at the rally, and we were married 10 weeks later. And when I met Roger, I remember writing that it was like standing on the shores of an ocean, and the waves just rolling in, and somehow I knew that I was encountering and finally embracing a much bigger world than just the world of theatrical and film and television acting that I'd been involved with. And so throughout our marriage, I have become more and more involved with the things that Roger's dealing with the issues that he's dealing with. And so now I've written this little book, which I've published in America and is now going to be published in Australia and New Zealand and England and then worldwide, called What Can I Do? An Alphabet for Living, which is a series of websites that you can go to find information that will help us to understand the problems that we face on the earth today, the problem that the earth faces, the problem as a living system, the problems that we face through those problems with water and energy and global warming, which is huge, and population and food and everything. I mean, the degradation of every part of the living structure of the earth, and the simple things that we can do to start changing the way we live on the earth, to heal it, really, and to heal ourselves, and to start being more considerate about the way in which we squander the resources that we all share with each other. You know, nothing really belongs to any of us. It's all we are one of millions of species on this planet, and so we have to learn to be more careful with the way we use the resources of this one little home that we have, which is the Earth, which is in the size of the universe, it's pretty tiny.
Lisa, the book is put out by Chelsea Green Publishing, and they're doing some wonderful things in terms of environmental publishing these days.
Yeah.
Going back to the moment when you met Roger, and by the way, for those who don't know who Roger is, can you give us a quick summary since we're starting this program?
Well, Roger is a whale biologist, and some say he's the world's leading cetologist. He very modestly says, no, that's not so. But the reason he became very powerful in the world of whales was because he was the co-discoverer of, well, along with a man called Scott McBay, of the fact that humpback whales sing, and these sounds that pour out of the ocean are in fact song, and he made a record. Well, he made several records, but the first one, the songs of the humpback whales, that hit the world, I think, in the late 60s, and it's astonishing yet still how many people meet us and go, oh my God, I remember those, and my children went to sleep with those sounds, and how moving they were, and it really transformed the environmental movement that started, you know, the Save the Whale movement. People suddenly began to realize, oh, that these dark, mysterious monsters of the deep actually had souls and created music and were most beautiful, profoundly beautiful to listen to. And it gave them a sense, or gave us a sense of their magic, that allowed us to go then further into actually examining, what are we doing to these creatures? We were killing them massively at the time, and what's happening with their habitat, and their spirit spoke to us, and so we were able to somehow link into them, and it helped to develop the Save the Whales movement and then other huge environmental movements as a result. So that's who Roger is. His name is Roger Payne.
Legendary human being, and I think, again, I totally agree that his research sort of scientifically proved that there was much more to animals than simply reacting to environmental stimulus. That is to say, they were much more profound than science and many others had been giving them credit for.
That's right. And he also runs in Argentina, down in Peninsula Valdez, the longest single species study that's been going on for 35, nearly 40 years now, of the southern right whale down in these, this wonderful bay in the wilds of Patagonia, where he took his family when they were young children. And it's interesting, we've just had his family all here with us, and their bond as a family is incredibly powerful because they spent so much time with Roger and his wife out there in the wild, living in the wild world, and connecting with other species apart from our own in a very profoundly challenging and beautiful way, I think. And it's led to four remarkable children.
We're going to have the great pleasure of talking with Roger sort of in our next segment of sorts. But Lisa, let's continue. This is what I'd be curious about at a personal level, because I'm always amazed at when people begin to really expand their awareness of this interconnection of all of life on the Earth. What happened? What happened to you? Because apparently, as you really got to know Roger, and you moved from Earthmates to life mates, that is the way I like to think of you two, How did your awareness grow, and your appreciation, your sensitivity? You're already there, but which is therefore great. But what began to happen to you personally? What was your growth like?
Well, I tell you, the first thing that began happening to me was I began to realize how poisonous plastic was to us and to our life on Earth. And very early on in our relationship, a woman called Theo Colburn came for dinner, and she had written, was one of the co-writers of a book called Our Stolen Future, about persistent organohalogens, POPs, in the environment, and what these man-made molecules, which are indestructible, which break down in fatty tissues and which get swirled around by the oceans, the winds, and into the ocean, consumed by little tiny creatures in the sea, and then they go up the food chain until they're in the fatty tissue of big fishes, and what and the appalling things that happen to us over generations, and to sea life, and to plant, I mean, to everything, because of these, the infestation in the earth of these man-made molecules. The effect that the Industrial Revolution has had on us. I mean, it's been a wonderful thing, the Industrial Revolution, everything that has come out of the Industrial Revolution, but like all things beneficial, there's always seems to be a downside. And the downsides don't appear until much later. And I guess I began to realize, fundamentally, that we have to be more careful of leaping into a new technology without thinking, without realizing, without considering the consequences. And of course, sometimes the consequences are not even there. I mean, lead and petrol, look how long it took for that campaign to take off, because people didn't realize for so long that lead and petrol was such a poisonous substance, just particularly to urban children. And so I used to sit in Roger's office and watch these faxes coming in about the death of fisheries and the POPs that were in the food that they were eating, in the natural food from the oceans that they were eating. And so I just became, I'm a very curious person, but I'm also, I feel that nothing here belongs to me. I mean, I'm just passing through, like all of us. I don't feel that I have any right to jeopardize the future health and well-being of any species on this planet by the way I treat the world in which I live. Needless to say, I drive a car, but now I've got a hybrid, but that really doesn't make much difference. And we live in the middle of the country, so we have to use our car a lot more than I would wish. I mean, I'm not a purist in that sense. I just try to be aware of the things that I do. And I guess it was out of that awareness and the consequences of those things that, and then Roger developing this program and this Lessons from Copernicus. And we did it a couple of times in its early stages. And I realized immediately, oh my God, we need a tool, because the audiences kept saying, well, okay, so we buy your message, now what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. What can I do? And as an actress, I heard an audience requiring more information. And now, I would, as an actress, if I was playing a character, would start to enrich my character, but what I realized was that we had to write this little book and give it away to a member of the audience. which is how What Can I Do started out. Now, and then Chelsea Green picked it up, and that was great. But I just look at these things practically and try and find and get excited about the things that are happening in the world that are changing the way we live. And I want the people out there to know about these things and get as much excitement and pleasure out of them as I do.
Lisa, What Can I Do? An Alphabet for Living, again, is put out by Chelsea Green Publishing.
Yeah.
I encourage everybody to look at their
first. I also started a website.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is whatcanidousa.org,
mm-hmm.
to add to the information in the book. Because
excellent.
I keep finding things that should mm-hmm. be in the book and can't be because the book was finished. But so I'm now doing that too, which is something, if you'd said to me a year ago you'd be doing an environmental website, I would have been, I just wouldn't have believed you.
Give us that website.
It's called whatcanidousa.org.
Very good. Now here's the question that I'd like to, because the book is fabulous. It has, I don't know links and descriptions of all sorts of organizations that are doing, it's arranged alphabetically so people can just sort of look up a topic and find out who's doing what and go there and do something, which is what this is about. What have you found, since you've had the opportunity to really pull all of this information together, to be some of your favorites, some of the people who are doing the work that you feel is most important?
Well, there's the book thing down in Baltimore.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And this was one of my favorite, because some of the things I do is people who did. And this was one of my favorite guys who was just working in a bar. Because to me, the most important thing is that ordinary people, you know, normal people like me, not scientists or environmentalists or people with titles, but ordinary people like you and me who are just going about our lives, how we can find the things that can be done. Now, this was a young man who was wandering around America in his car, just doing the odd job, and he's working in a bar in Baltimore, and the teachers kept coming in after school at the end of the day on Friday for their happy hour, and were talking about the fact that, oh my God, there were just no books in the schools, and they had library hour, and what could they do with library hour with no books, and the kids didn't have any books at home. And so this man, Russell, began listening to this, and he thought, I love books, this is crazy. So he picked up the tips from his bar that night, went out the next week, and with his tips every day that week, he bought books from secondhand bookshops and things like that. And the following Friday night, when the teachers arrived, there were a pile of books in the trunk of this guy's car. And he said, take them. And they said, oh my God. He said, no, take them. It's just, I just think you need to just take them for the kids. So gradually people began to hear about this, and they start bringing him in books for the book thing, his book thing. So then he took over a building, the basement of the building in which he lived, and he turned it into a place where people could deposit books. And he began very soon collecting 10,000 books a week and giving those books to the schools and to homeless people and to old people's homes and to anyone who wanted them. People, and so it became a community place where people kept coming in and looking at things and finding information. And the only the really, really good books he sold, because he could then make money for his non-profit. And he had a list around of all the schools in the area of all the books they needed that were on their reading list and stuff, and he set them aside and gave them to them. And everything else he just gives away free. Now, a lot of people have books, and they don't know what to do with them because there's so many, and they get dumped. I mean, our local library in Dartmouth, I was talking to them about this, and they dump books, they throw them away. Well, there's another huge problem for us, and that's, what do we do with the waste? I mean, the biggest mountain on the eastern seaboard of America is the trash mountain at Fresh Kills, full of trash from New York. Now, trash, garbage, it's beginning to rule our lives because we can't keep manufacturing it and dumping it because there's nowhere to dump it. So one has to start thinking about alternative ways to use trash. So Zero Waste is another site that I really love. And I love, there's also some sites out there under compost, which there are towns in Canada now which are collecting plants, you know, vegetable garbage from homes. You know, when you peel the potatoes and you make the spinach and you cut the bits off and you make the salad, all that stuff that normally goes into the garbage, they're collecting it as compostable material along with paper and cardboard and things like that, and collecting it in these great municipal sites and composting it and turning it into soil and putting it back to the earth. replenishing the soil, which is something else that we're losing fast, rapidly, more quickly than we need to. So it's the interconnectivity of these things that I really love. That's what I, and so as you weave through the book, you find, oh, that leads to that, and that leads to that, and of course, the reality is that we live in a closed-loop system, which is one of the things I discovered with working with Roger on this program, and that every other species on this planet does not produce waste. We're the only species that produces waste, and we should produce waste that can be recycled. We have to learn how to reuse every single thing that we produce. And now in Europe, there are car manufacturers and manufacturers of other industrial processes, which at the end of the life of that machine that they produce, the machine is taken back and broken down to its component parts and remade into a new one. It's not dumped. That's what Interface Carpets are doing with carpets. They're remaking carpets out of old carpets. And we have to learn to do that. And that's, what does that mean? It means more jobs. It means good business. It means money for the economy. So, in fact, waste is something that shouldn't be. It should be created into new forms of things that we can use. And, I mean, when I talk about waste, I talk about waste of people as well as waste of things. Mm-hmm. So we just have got to think about how we've been living on this planet, which until now has supported us in a very wonderful way, but is no longer able to. And we have to just rethink a bunch of things. And we can do that. We're very smart creatures. You know,
I think actually we're going to reach a point. We're going to reach a critical mass. We're going to find that 100th monkey of awareness. And I think the planet is reaching that point, although it's hard to see. But I can feel it.
We've already outgrown it. In 1972, there was a National Academy of Sciences report which said that that's when we outgrew the sustainable provisions of this planet. And now we need a land mass as big as Europe and Australia to continue to support us where we are now. You know, I mean, we've already extended ourselves beyond the provisions of this planet. But you're right, we don't see this. I think if we lived in one of these huge bustling cities where the pressure of people was so great that we kind of see it, but it's
the challenges are stacking up, and I think part of the problem that we have is that the media doesn't really present the message in a way in which leads to real solutions. It kind of is always a crisis, you know. Mm-hmm. And what you've done is you've actually presented this as a what can I do, and really we do have to just do it.
Yeah.
And your book certainly leads to that, to some of those solutions. So obviously, this is one little piece, but an important piece. It's something that every home should have. Not because I'm trying to necessarily promote the book, but because I'm trying to promote the message, which is even more important than the book itself.
Well, I think the funny with things like what do you do if you have a wedding and all that food is left over? This is something else that happened. A friend of mine, her daughter got married in our local hotel over in Hanover, and they went round back to the hotel to pick up a car, and all these cheesecakes and food were lying in the bins, and they said, "What?" And they were untouched. And what they could have done was taken that food and taken it to the hospitals, to the old people's homes, to the homeless who live in the area. Second Harvest is a great organization that's in the book that does just this. And if every single person, when they have a big family gathering, didn't throw away the food, but actually recycled it, gave it to other people, first of all, you would feel that you would be providing nourishment to people who don't have good food, and it would be a good thing. But also, more importantly, that stuff wouldn't be going into the river then. It would be being reused or used properly and finished. Then there's this. So that's a great site. There's another site where you can take your old ball gowns and give them to girls who are too poor to really, don't have the resources to give themselves a beautiful prom dress and a lovely night out for their high school prom. Well, there are organizations now that collect, clothes and shoes and bags, all the stuff that clutter up our wardrobes that we don't, our closets that we don't use anymore, cosmetics, things like that, and make these girls night. I mean, make change their lives, I think. Now, that's a good thing to be doing. It's really what I'm aiming with this book is to make people feel positive about the steps that they take in order to help themselves, because in the end, the environment is us and our children and our grandchildren. We're not separate from it. It's not something that's out there, you know, in the green fields. It's within us, because everything that happens out there in the green field impacts us, our health, our well-being, our mental state, I mean, and our ability to grow and flourish as a species.
So. Absolutely right. You're really addressing the consumerist issue, and we really do have to face this. It isn't anti-corporate, it isn't anti-anything. It really just has to do with the fact that we've reached a point where we simply must change. We have to kind of turn the corner here. Yeah. And start recycling sort of our vision back into our own communities and say we need to help each other out. We don't always have to be buying new. There's many things that we can do, and we need to build these into our societies.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
That's right. I mean, Christmas presents, older children could give younger children, older cousins could give younger cousins their favorite toys when they've outgrown them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that kind of thing can happen too. But it's really just how we deal with this. Because, of course, people are going to say, well, you know, that means that you're cutting out the jobs for the people who make the toys. And that's true. But on the other hand, the population is ever growing. You know, it's not, we don't have a declining population. So people are always going to want toys. It's just how we view the... It's got to be a major mind shift, isn't it, really, about realizing that everything that we pick up has come from somewhere and something has been depleted in order to make it. And so does that hairdryer, I mean, that plastic hairdryer that I throw away, or the mobile phones, there's an example. I mean, millions of them in the world now. Batteries are the poisonous things that go into the landfill. But you know, there are these organizations that, what do you do with your old mobile phone? Well, you can give it to a charity who gives it to people who are in, because they can ring 911 on them for no charge, who may not want to have a mobile phone, but they may want something because they're living under some sense of duress or stress or something, and they may want to have that phone to hand whereby if suddenly they're in danger, or a child is in danger, they can call 911 and be rescued. And so what better thing to do with an old cell phone than to throw it away, and so that it poisons the water that seeps out of the landfill, and you know, and all those things. It's just really coming to understand what these complicated issues are and how we set about trying to change our mindsets about it, and that's a really big problem. But that's just the little step I took to help people know where to start looking for the information. That's the important thing, because once you're informed, you can make decisions much more easily, I think.
Well, Lisa, you've taken a simple step here and outlined a wonderful, simple book called What Can I Do? A beautiful little book, An Alphabet for Living. And that's on a very practical level. But when we come back, we're going to look at some of the more creative and expressive ways in which you, as a Shakespearean actress and and creative person and caring person, are taking this to another level with Roger Payne, your husband. And so when we return, we're going to have a talk with Roger about some of his work, and then we're going to come back in the third segment and put it both together in Lessons from Copernicus, which is a performance piece that you two are bringing to the world. It's a most important statement. Thank you, Lisa Harrow.
Thanks, Sydney.
You bet. Thanks. So to the sea we go. It's a whale hunt for answers to their future and ours. When we return to this special Voice of the Earth edition of the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Passion and genius and a willingness to risk it all. It's a recipe for wonder. And when we return, we take a journey to the mind and spirit of scientist, explorer, artist, and friend of the earth, Dr. Roger Payne. Each time you hear a humpback whale sing, you scratch one notch on his totemic legacy. It's off to the sea we go. Get out your telescope and search with us for the new lands of our future when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and we're continuing a journey with a couple, a very interesting couple. I think of them as Earthmates. They met sort of over the issue and the substance of the Earth and have become life mates, quite honestly, in a larger spectrum. They really are trying to do everything they can to preserve life on planet Earth here. Roger Payne is an extraordinarily legendary scientist and researcher, specifically as it relates to whales, and I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with one of his most significant early works, which was a series of recordings, because he was one of the people who discovered the fact that humpback whales and other whales, which made all these sounds and different things, as all animals do, but he was able to take this and analyze it and say, you know, they're not just making noises here, they're communicating, and the communication is at a very high level. Roger, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much. Sydney, I can't prove communication in whales. What whales are actually doing was producing songs.
Okay, the songs, truly. It was the songs of the humpback whales, to be very specific. Talk about that, the songs of the humpback whales.
Well, they're wonderful, extraordinary utterances of animals which are... So they seem to be some form of communication which speaks directly to the emotional sense of people, and some people respond to hearing them for the first time by weeping. And so you get the impression of something with an enormous power over just the human imagination. There are some interesting aspects to them. My former wife, Katie Payne, discovered that they change, and that also she and another woman, Linda Guinea, discovered that they employ rhyme in their songs and change the endings of various phrases as they're changing them. They maintain a rhyme, for example. These rhymes are used in the songs to apparently remember complicated stuff, because songs which are more complex have more rhymes in them than songs which are very simple and straightforward. And so it seems to be sort of the same kind of mnemonic or memory device which the old troubadours used in order to remember stuff, by using rhyme as a way of tweaking their memory and getting the next phrase. This fact that humpbacks sang was something that Scott McVeigh and I discovered together, and it's a really exciting way, we felt, of getting the world interested in stopping the killing of whales, and I think it proved to be so, and it's one of the things that spurred the start of the movements like the Save the Whales movement, really, which were taken to much greater heights by other people like Greenpeace and other organizations, took it a great distance, and gave us eventually a moratorium, and all of us began to think at that point, we've done it, we've saved the whales. And now I realize, it took me a while to realize it, but in many ways a moratorium is the best thing that ever happened to the whaling industry, because everybody thought, well, we've won, and gave up and got interested in other things, and the result is the whaling industry is inexorably moving back, coming into existence again. Nobody listening to this program will live long enough to see the end of whaling. It will go on and on and on, and the people who profit from it are just getting cleverer and cleverer, and at the moment they are persuading other nations to join the International Whaling Commission. And these other nations, because of the gratitude they feel to the whalers, are voting with the whalers, even though they include nations like Tuva in Asia, which I think, I don't know, maybe it's probably at least 1,000 miles from the nearest coast, not a very famous bunch of whalers.
Well, we've come a long way since the time of the original Song of the Humpback Whales, and the issues are becoming much more complex. The more that we learn, the more that we understand that as our societies are expanding their realms into the oceans and their technologies, and now we're having the military usage of the ocean for various forms of deep sonar, that we're really beginning to affect the capacity specifically for whales, conceivably, to communicate or to sing. What is happening with that? Are we making progress in this arena in trying to turn this around, or are we going the other direction?
Well, I think people are finally beginning to recognize how serious the problem is. Chris Clark, who worked early on in his career with me and is now going way, way beyond mine, Chris has demonstrated recently that the area within which two whales can expect to hear each other in the North Atlantic has shrunk by two orders of magnitude, by something over 100 times. So they used to be able, a thing that I proposed years ago and Chris later confirmed by observation in the ocean, these whales are able to hear each other completely across oceans. Well, they were, and now they can't because there's so much traffic noise in the ocean. They're down to hearing each other in a very small little area. Now, whether or not that's going to have an effect on their population is not known, but my guess is, let's see, do we think it's going to improve their chances of meeting each other and reproducing or not? Because this is a species that does not collect together on breeding grounds. It's the species like the blue, the fin whales. They just wander the world's oceans and presumably come together by hearing each other's songs. And those songs are now being drowned out by ships' traffic.
Roger, tell us what kind of noises are being added to the ocean environment that are affecting their communication.
Well, the worst thing is the propeller noise from ships and motor noise to some degree, but propeller noise far more. And the whole ocean is simply throbbing with ships' traffic. There's no place you can go and get away from it completely. You can get to areas where the sound is less loud. But in major ocean areas, which are crisscrossed by shipping lanes, you have 24 hours a day this kind of roar going on. The ocean has always been a noisy place. Originally, it would be before there were propellers in the sea. Sailboats don't make any noise to speak of, but the propeller-driven ships began that. So about 150 years ago, it all began. There is in the ocean a whole collection of sounds which have been there all along. And at the very lowest frequencies, there are things like the earth cracking and little tiny tremors of the earth, which are really earthquakes, but just tiny little ones, and very nearly silent ones, but they make a low, dull roar. And then things like storms and wind noise and tides dragging stones across the bottom and waves crashing onto beaches and rain on the surface, and then also flashes of lightning. The flashes of lightning now are louder than a great many sounds that are produced by human beings underwater. Only explosions could equal that. There are tens of millions of lightning flashes which are striking the earth every year, and most of those go into the ocean because the ocean is 70% of the earth.
That's amazing. I had no idea that lightning would actually have that impact, and therefore maybe in some respects, it makes some of our noises and the challenges that we create for whales well within the realm of acceptability.
Yes, they are perhaps tolerable, but that's because for the most part they don't last very long. A lightning bolt doesn't last very long, but it does tell you that whales have to have mighty resilient ears if they're going to live in this loud noise background. And I suspect that they're capable of dealing with a lot more noise than we're afraid they are capable of dealing. But the precautionary principle is in order here. It's not wise to just go ahead and blast things into the ocean the way we now are doing. The two major sources of real acoustic damage are something which are called air guns. It's an array of noisemakers dragged behind a ship, which sets up very loud sounds that go down to the bottom and actually penetrate substrates and tell the oil industry what's lying underneath the bottom at that point. But, of course, any of the industry that pays for such a survey won't share the results with its competitor industry. So you have the phenomenon of areas which are crisscrossed by one company after another, which is an outrageous waste, really, of the ears of the animals that have to listen to all of this. The other great problem seems to be, at the moment, what are called mid-range sonars, sonars which are used by warships to locate submarines, anti-submarines sonars. There's been a lot of discussion about extreme low frequencies, and I can't imagine they do much good to whales, but I don't think they represent the threat that a lot of people have thought they do. But air guns and mid-range sonars sure do.
The fact that these are continuous now in some areas, is that leading to evidence of true disorientation by whales?
There's very definite evidence that whales are put up onto beaches, particularly at the moment, beaked whales, as a result of the loud noises that are made by air guns and by mid-range sonars. There's really no question that that's happening. So one of the things that needs to be done is that where these sonars are where practice runs are being made with them, and also where the oil industry is working, they should pay attention, close attention, to whether or not there are whales in the area at that season, and if there are, to wait until the whales have moved on.
Are you finding acceptance by the oil industry to work with you in this regard?
This is all too early to say. It's just brand new. I believe that their interests will be for the better and that they will work with us. That's what I'm looking forward to.
You have a wonderful ship called the Odyssey, and you've been on an Odyssey for the last 4 years. Tell us about that, and I'd like to know sort of what you've discovered that perhaps you hadn't really known that you could discover, and then also what kind of vision does this create for you in terms of where you look into the future from here?
Yes, well, my institute, the Ocean Alliance, has a boat called the Odyssey. It's a 93-foot steel ketch. It's been going around the world for, as you said, this is its fifth and final year. It has taken samples of the skin and blubber from 1,100 sperm whales. The reason we're choosing sperm whales is we're interested in what the concentrations of pollutants are in the little plugs of tissue that we get from the whale. And the pollutants we're after mostly are synthetic pollutants, things that humans have made that animals have not had a chance to develop or evolve methods to get rid of, and which accumulate in animals and cause them terrible mischief and terrible problems. Collectively, these things have a lot of different names. One of them is persistent organic pollutants, and the worst of those are things which are called EDCs, or endocrine disrupting compounds, because at incredibly low concentrations, they can mess up the endocrine system, the reproductive system of animals, and cause all kinds of terrible results. Nobody has looked globally at this problem. People have looked very specifically and done excellent work in little small areas to different species of animals, but nobody's tried to find out, okay, if this really is a problem to the oceans, you know, how far do you have to go to find out about it? And nobody has gone out there. And now I know why they haven't gone out there, which is that it is fantastically hard work over a long period of time. Raising the funds alone is just a monumental task. And also the finding and getting close to and getting a good sample from 1,100 whales is very hard to do. But we've now done it, and we've been out in the very most remote ocean regions. We've found sperm whales virtually everywhere we've gone. They're a wonderful species to study for two reasons. One, they have a lot of fat, which concentrates these substances. POPs are most soluble in fats. And two, they are a species in which females live in a completely different area than the males, and males then come visiting in order to mate with the females. Females live in equatorial or tropical waters, and the males go to polar waters, in both the northern and southern polar seas. And as a result, when you get a sample from a male that has come back from mating with a female, you know that its blubber was laid down not in the tropics but in the polar seas. So you have samples from all over the world by keeping your boat out of harm's way in calmer oceans and collecting samples from both males and females. The way we get the sample is to shoot a little dart into the back of the whale. Usually you don't get any response at all. When you do get a response, it's never very violent. It's just a twitch, basically. There is no more difficulty approaching a whale 5 minutes after you've taken a sample from it than there was when you got the sample. So they don't seem to now suddenly associate, you know, some horrible pain with the approach of this particular boat. In fact, I'm not even sure they're aware of it a lot of the time. The little hollow tube that gets the little plug of blubber and skin from the whale is, in relation to the whale's size, about half the diameter of the very smallest hypodermic syringe needles, which are used by diabetics to inject themselves four times a day. So it's not a huge trauma on the whale, I don't think, but it will, I hope, help make the whale's home, the oceans, a safer place for them and for the other top predator that feeds at the tops of long food chains in the oceans, and that's us. And the reason feeding it on food chains is an important issue is that there is a concentration of pollutants as you move from one predation level up to the next, from one food pyramid or food chain step to the next. And at each new level of predation, you end up with about 10 times as much concentration of substance as you had in the previous one, so that if you're feeding at the top of a food pyramid that is 7 steps high, that's about where you and I eat fish, for example, that means you have a 10^7 increase in concentration. That's a 10 million times increase in concentration. So you can start with things that are vanishingly small concentrations in the ocean and build them up quickly. to give an idea of how bad that can be. In the case of pollutants like PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, this is a substance that is found in so many substances it would take the rest of the show to list them. These PCBs are now no longer intentionally made, but they're made at times in small quantities unintentionally. And they still are all through the environment. They were made, their principal use was as a liquid insulator inside of capacitors and transformers and power stations. And if all that material gets into the sea, we will lose access to fish in the sea. It'll just be too polluted to eat. The U.S. government says you can sell fish as long as it has no more than 2 parts per million of PCBs. If it's 50 parts per million, it's defined as a toxic waste. So what do you find in whales? Well, in mid-ocean, in killer whales, which are feeding on mid-ocean prey and not coming to the mouth of some river where there might be a factory upstream causing pollution, in these killer whales, you get 400 parts per million. If you do move into a river mouth, like, for example, the St. Lawrence, and look at beluga whales, up to 3,200 parts per million. And if you go off the east coast of the United States, off Megalopolis, you get 6,800 parts per million in bottlenose dolphins. You know, that's flipper. So these whales are basically swimming toxic dump sites. They would be eligible for cleanup under the Superfund site laws if you could clean them up, and you can't. Or if, I might say, the Superfund sites were being cleaned up. They're not anymore. It's all been put on hold. So the result is that, you know, this is a terrible, terrible threat to these animals, the buildup of these pollutants in the sea, and it's clearly gone way over limits that are considered to be toxic wastes by people. Just as a last note, if you took pity on some dolphin which had come ashore and it happened to be very polluted and you pushed it back into the ocean to save it, you would be eligible for a $10,000 fine for polluting the sea.
I'm laughing because it's weird. This is part of the sad truth. I think to help people understand, too, why this is so challenging, some people could say, well, so what? So the whales are getting polluted and their blubber is getting filled with toxic things. It's like, so what? But, you know, one of the disadvantages of the poor sea creatures is the fact that they're stuck in this environment. It's like one of the reasons that the frogs are going through such changes is the fact that the subtle changes in their environments, they can't escape because they're waterborne. And the whales as well are stuck in the water. So anything that goes into the water reaches everywhere. And the changes, as you say, specifically in the endocrine systems, are some of the most dramatic because they affect the capacity for this animal to function. And from my perspective, that's one of the biggest concerns. Are you finding that somewhat true?
Oh, absolutely. You know, with wildlife, there are abundant indicators of real problems in wildlife. You have fish which are genetically male, but phenotypically, in other words, the way they look is female. You have alligators with minute penises. You have all sorts of terrible problems with the beaks and the feet of seabirds and so on. And one of the most interesting things I ever saw was I was visiting a man who was one of the discoverers of the problems of club feet and twisted beaks in seabirds, and he pointed out that one day he finally realized, hey, wait a minute, you know, these are the animals that survived enough to hatch and develop and grow up, but what about the ones that were so badly affected by these substances that they didn't survive? So then he began going to the eggs of these same seabirds and collecting any which didn't hatch. And the stuff he got out of that would, I mean, make you say to Hollywood, come on, guys, get real. You know, what do you think you're trying to put over on us? I saw, for example, one of the embryos which he had collected, which was a heart with two eyes on it. I mean, that doesn't seem to be quite right. And you and I and everyone listening to this are in fact eating the stuff that produced that, and we're getting it with everything we eat, and we don't care, apparently. We just figure, oh, well, too bad. If a nursing mother had her milk in other containers besides her breast, she would not be allowed to take it over state lines. It's too polluted. Yet she, in that tenderest of all mammalian acts, nursing, is actually dumping her lifetime's accumulation of this stuff into her baby. Now, there's a way around it for a mother. She can feed her baby formula, but that is not an option for a whale. So you can perfectly well say that whales, unless somehow the pollution of the ocean is diminished by the steps that people take, are probably destined, in the case of many individual species, to go extinct. I see no way around that.
That really is your conclusion at this moment.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can think of some mechanism that will clean up the sea and therefore the whales well enough to prevent these substances from accumulating inexorably from generation to generation. You see, it's not just, they don't concentrate only as you move up food chains. They also concentrate as you move from generation to generation. So the baby that got a meal from its mother got basically its mother's lifetime accumulation of stuff up to the point when she gave birth to the baby. Then the baby adds its own lifetime accumulation to that, the baby whale, let's say. And then the whale, then she gives birth to a calf of her own, into which she pumps milk, which has, therefore, twice the accumulation she got from her mother. And that calf will pump milk into its babe, which will have three times the amount that its grandmother had. So you add this up with every generation. It doesn't matter if it's a very small amount that's added each time. You will accumulate it inexorably. And eventually you reach concentrations which will, I presume, cause havoc with endocrine systems.
The capacity for these animals to naturally reproduce, natural animals, is becoming very seriously threatened, and it's tragic. I was hoping you were going to give me a good answer as to what we might do. If you could wave a magic wand, let's dream for a moment here. How could we turn this around?
No, I think we need to care. We need to, you know, when I'm, let's say you and I own a power company and the transformer just went out and we've got to get another one online. We have irate customers calling in saying, you know, where's my power and so on. And now you have this old beat up transformer that's no use to you anymore. And the question is, well, what do you do with it? Well, I don't know, you get the damn thing out of there, you get rid of it. But the point is, if there were a law and a little market that could be built up, you could persuade some local guy to buy up an old used fuel tanker from some trucking company, and he could have a little business going around collecting the oil that was in these transformers and taking it down to some facility which can either oxidize or reduce it down to its completely harmless components, and that would mean it wouldn't get into the system and eventually make its way to the ocean, which is where absolutely everything that spills on the surface of the earth eventually ends up. It may take a while, but it eventually gets there. Then people used to say, oh yes, the solution to pollution is dilution, and there's plenty of water in the ocean and you can dilute things, and the answer is wrong, because what happens is there is this inexorable building upwards in food chains of concentrations until what you end up with is this stuff being fed back to you at concentrations which, in fact, can really cause you trouble. So I always used to imagine the scenario of a mother grabbing a bottle of this, well, some PCB, let's say, from the hands of her child and thinking, my Lord, you almost drank it, and then pouring it down the sink, which basically guarantees that it will come back either to that child or some other child somewhere else, because it will be reconcentrated by food chains and then eaten as a nice fish someday when somebody has fish.
In my experience, there are people who understand these things. It's almost like people are born into the world with this caring sense about their relationship to the planet and the living systems. And then there are those who seem not to. It seems to me the challenge is, how do we reach those who don't have a natural proclivity to feel these things? Any ideas on that?
I don't have any that I think would necessarily do the job, obviously, completely, but I do feel it's a matter of education, and that it's a matter of the kind of education that really sticks with you, which is often very informal kinds of education. I've always thought there ought to be a soap opera, basically, on with you know, an interesting group of people in it that the listeners and our viewers got to know, and slowly they would face various problems which had to do with the environment, but not done in such a way that was jamming it down your throat, but in fact which was subtle and funny and made the people who were involved in it entertaining and fun to be around, so to speak. Because when you're in this field, when you're a scientist and you know, you did your time, you learned your stuff that you had to do it, and you interact with other scientists who are doing the same kind of things, you find they're wonderful people. They're fun to be with. They're a ball. I have a few of my colleagues. Tom Eisner at Cornell is a man who really taught me biology. He's one of the most entertaining individuals I've ever met in my life. He's hilarious, as well as being such a fine scientist that he won the Presidential Medal of Science. I mean, they're people of that sort throughout, and they're just a ball to be around. They aren't some thick head in a white coat making pronouncements. They're wonderful human beings who really have something to say.
When we come back, we're going to experience another level of this discussion as we look at Lessons from Copernicus, which actually begins to take that concept and flesh it out and craft it into something that you too are reaching out into the planet to try to really bring about a greater caring world. So, Roger Payne, I want to thank you for being on the Wild Side News at this point. And then when we return, we're going to get Lisa and Roger together. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
'Twas a time when the earth was flat, and all who ventured dared to fall off the edge and into the unknown. And then, the man Copernicus faced the masters and proclaimed, "There is no edge, there is no end. This is our earth, our home, our planet, and we are sailing in the winds around our sun." And the earth turned. And so, too, the truth was honored. It's Lessons from Copernicus with Lisa Harrow and Roger Payne, when we return here on the Wild Side News. And so we return our visit with two wizards on the planet, Lisa Harrow and Roger Payne, who are a team. They're a team together, and they're working as life mates and are really dedicating their lives, as they always have, to preserving life in all of its forms and its best forms on planet Earth. Lisa, good to have you back again.
Good to be back.
And Roger, you know, how in the world did you get so excited about Lisa?
It's not hard.
Yeah, okay.
I used to say it took me 45 seconds, but I think it was less than that, actually. When I heard her and I heard her voice, I thought, my gosh, I was doing a film at the time, and I wanted somebody to read some passages from Moby Dick, and I wanted it to be a woman, not a man. And I heard Lisa's voice, and I thought, my Lord, that's the most intelligent voice I've heard in I don't know how long. And we began talking, and she's told the rest of the story, but she spent her career playing leading roles opposite people like Peggy Ashcroft and Pierce Brosnan and Peter Coyote, Judy Dench, John Gielgud, Richard Grant, Jared Harris, Anthony Hopkins, John Hurt, Jeremy Irons, Sam Neill, Peter O'Toole, Patrick Stewart, David Suchet, and just on and on. Incredible people who are themselves amazing actors, and whenever Lisa does a play, actors come to see it because she's at a level that I don't think there are 10 people who can do what she can do. And the result was, I began, whenever she did a play, I began going not just to see it once, you know, oh, very nice, dear, I thought it was nice, but I started going to all the performances I could. She did Wit in New York, I saw it 42 times. And because of that, and getting much more familiar than one normally does with the play, I realized that, holy mackerel, there is a level of communication going on between an actor like Lisa and the audience that can't possibly be achieved by some mere smear biologist like myself. Wouldn't it be incredible if you could get that kind of talent applied to things that you believed in as well, to the environment particularly? It turned out that fitted exactly with Lisa's interests, which was serendipity. The rest was her talent. And so the idea was to do some program which became something we call Lessons from Copernicus, in which you get the knowledge of a scientist and the wisdom of a poet involved in trying to give an idea of the world, the wild world, and our place in it and where human beings stand. And the idea was that I would talk about science and Lisa would do poetry. And the poetry she did would be more expansive of what I'm talking about. And it's been a huge treat. We're just getting going with it. we've done it a few times experimentally and improved and changed it. She wrote a book as a result of it, which is What Can I Do?, which got rave reviews, by the way, from people like Avery Lovins and E.O. Wilson and Tom Eisner, as well as Patrick Stewart. This kind of effort, I think, really is what's needed, because I see the main problem that we're facing at the moment as a problem with getting people to really set forth what they believe in, say what structures their inner world. And the neocons managed to turn the last election, in my view, into basically a demonstration that gay marriage is a greater threat to the United States than global warming. Well, I don't happen to agree with that, but it does say a very, very important lesson, which is they showed the power of saying what really moves you, what you live by, what you're interested in. I don't share what they live by, but I see the power of doing that. And I feel that that is the step that has been missing for far too long. This last election should have been, there are so many issues that should have come out that didn't about the environment. And I would hope that in the future people who have as passionate a view towards the environment as, for example, I do or Lisa has or millions of other people have, that that will come forward and people stop just remaining silent on it, but talk about it, because it is not something that should divide people, it should unite them. It is the, like a wide open yawning door to a future world of vast new opportunities. In terms of jobs opportunities, my word, nothing could solve the jobs problem as well as getting into environmental solutions. It also adds hugely to human health. There are so many benefits from it. I mean, one of the ones it benefits from is that I can't really think of a more desirable target if I was a terrorist than a nuclear power plant. And I can't really think of a less desirable target than a windmill. And windmills will produce the same amount of power if, as a nuclear power plant, if you build enough of them. Let us say that we built 100,000 of them across the United States, we could get well over half the power that we need, and we'd be getting it from the wind, and we would be frustrating terrorism by it at the same time, living safer lives for all of us. These are opportunities and not things that are going to make things more expensive. They will, in the end, make things much less expensive.
I certainly agree with that wholeheartedly and endlessly try to promote the concept that the future economy in the United States and the world is going to be wrapped up in our environment. I refer to it as the nature industry in all of its manifestations, and it's absolutely critical. It is the new economy. This is the new digital technology, and that is energy self-sufficiency. I totally agree. Lisa?
Yes, I was just going to say that we called it Lessons from Copernicus after Nicholas Copernicus, who, as everyone knows, discovered that the Earth was not the center of the universe, as had been believed up until that point in 1530, but that actually the Earth revolved around the Sun. And he was vilified for this information. And the interesting thing is that he stated a fact. He stated something that is true. Regardless of what you believe, there are physical laws that life on this Earth demands that we follow. Basically, what we're talking about is a natural law, that you can obey the laws of Congress, you can obey the laws of Parliament, you can obey any laws you like, but the laws of physics and the laws of nature will win you, will beat you every time. And the sooner we all start realizing that there are these absolute laws that we need to live by, the happier our lives will be and the more solid. So that's why it's called Lessons from Copernicus.
I would love it if it were possible for you to give our audience an entree to how you communicate this information.
Well, great. I need to put down the phone and do a little thing.
While we're on hold here,
yes.
Okay. Are you aware of anybody who has approached sort of Shakespeare today? You know, if Shakespeare were here, how would he interpret this world?
Of course he would approach the world with the same genius that he approached the world that he was in then, and he would write. And he would be the philosopher and the understander and communicator of the human condition that he was. He had an amazing capacity to understand the complexity of human life and put it into words that were just thrilling. Now, he chose the medium of language because that's what everyone communicated with in those days. Would he be making movies now? I don't think so, because movies and not words. It's funny, a friend of mine, a professor of Shakespeare, he's retired now, in Santa Barbara, considers that Midsummer Night's Dream, and he's just written a book about this, is the most environmental play that's ever been written. Because there's a speech that Titania gives where, when Oberon and she are fighting, and she says, you know, this fight between us has caused the world to go into these strange things are happening, and tides are rising too full, and storms, I mean, she describes global warming, really. And she says, and it's because of our argument, because of our fight, and we must stop fighting. I mean, he's male and she's the female force of the world, and that these two energies are in great combat over a child. Well, it's a child. The child could be humanity. And because the male can't, Oberon can't get what he wants, he goes and takes it and is violent. And his violence causes savagery on the earth and deep destruction of all of its systems. So, I mean, people are looking at his writing with those ideas in mind, but what Shakespeare would make of this, I mean, I would hope that he would write with the same passion and humor and despair, the poetry and great insight that he always had. The greatest experience I ever had with Shakespeare was performing it in Japan to Japanese who didn't speak English, but who looked upon Shakespeare as their own because they loved what he said about the human condition.
He had a way, of putting it all together in this. He touched so deeply, fear and passion and
everything.
Yes. And I just wish I could figure out how we're able to do that in this day and age, you know, so that...
We don't have the man to write, this is true. Mm-hmm. But then we don't have a Beethoven either, and we don't have a Bach.
Yeah.
So why is that? Well, I do believe that artists grow from the time that nurtures them. I mean, Shakespeare was at a time when the Renaissance was bursting into England. There was huge struggles between the Catholic and the Protestant churches. The Reformation had happened. He had a queen on the throne, which was... And she was an exceptionally brilliant woman. She was and she took England from this rather backward country and brought it to the forefront with her passionate view of making everything that was British English to be it's the best that the world could offer. And at the same time as that was happening, he was living in a very small community, which although it was the city of London, it was tiny, and the expansion, the exploration of the world that was going on down at the docks, all these boats were coming back with all these stories and adventures and people having amazing things to say about the world that they were discovering, and ideas were fermenting around them. I mean, I don't believe there's ever been a time like that in terms of the small number of people who were accessing the extraordinary growing up of information and stuff that was happening. I mean, America was being discovered at this point. And so it was a time like this, but nowadays there are so many more people and so much more. I mean, we don't get our information now from actually having it communicated to us. We either read it in the newspaper if we're lucky and if we're intelligent enough to realize that that's how we should get our information, or we sit and get it drifted at us through the television. Or you do what Roger and I do, and listen to the BBC all night, and we get it that way. Whereas in those days, they actually got it by communicating with each other. Now, in doing that, they created... I mean, Shakespeare was writing at a time when everybody was writing. If you wanted to say to somebody, I love you, you wrote her a sonnet. You know, and that has certain disciplines about it. You know, it has a rhyme, it has to have a structure, it has to have 14... lines. It has to have X number of syllables in the line because it's got to have that meter. It's no good just writing it, you know, going down and getting a Hallmark card and a red rose. No. It'd be much more if you were an intelligent, a kind of a hip guy in the community. That's what you had to do. And I think that Shakespeare's life, I mean, and his ideas, clearly he was extraordinarily smart. But he grew up in this tiny little town in the middle of nowhere in Warwickshire. He got out. He went to the place where the world was changing, and he changed with the world. And why did he do that? Well, maybe he was just a human being who could think outside the box like Copernicus, who could think in a way that was different from the conventional way of thinking. And he had the artistry and the talent to write superbly of the ideas that he was surrounded by. They also were educated so well. I mean, we do Latin and Greek and study our history from the ancient Romans and the ancient Greeks now. Do we have to do classical literature in order to pass our exams? No. Mm-hmm. We don't do any of that now.
I do believe, scientifically, that we have a literal sense of beauty. That when we perceive beauty in its various forms, whether it's visual or audio or words, but particularly visual and audio, that we perceive it, we feel it. And I think the best example of that, if you come across a particularly extraordinary vista, or if you walk into an exceptional cathedral, the human behavioral reaction to that is an intaking of breath. We just that is how we respond to beauty. What I find interesting is the fact that it seemed as if the ancients seemed to know that. That's how you spell awe. You know, it's called awe.
Yes.
We say it was so beautiful it took my breath away.
Yes.
I believe that we have this literal sense of beauty. And unfortunately, as we look at where we are now, beauty is a lost art. I mean, there are certainly people who create beauty, but in terms of the realms of art or even our society, it is not beauty that is guiding us and leading us to survival. From a biological perspective, beauty, which is based in balance and harmony and different things, is the secret to all survival. Things must be balanced. And so those creatures that somehow perceive that, whether they're humans or others, had a survival advantage because they were in tune with the truth.
Yes.
That's my little...
Interesting you should say that. One of the poems in our piece is The Leaden Echo and the Golden Echo by Gerard Manley Hopkins. And that's the turning point of the program. It's like a Bach cantata. I mean, it's a Bach unaccompanied violin sonata to beauty.
Yes.
And that's precisely what it's about. And it's about taking beauty back into our lives.
And if we were to do that, then all of a sudden the animals become... They are the manifestors of ultimate beauty, because there's not a single creature out there that's ugly when you really look at it.
No.
Not a single one, or a plant, or anything.
Well, there's a wonderful... Roger has a friend in England who does microscopic photography, and he took my breath away when he showed us pictures of larval lobsters and clams and these little tiny, tiny creatures, which you don't actually see, that live in the top surface of the water.
Yes.
So beautiful, and they're microscopic.
Yes.
I mean, there's no reason for them to be beautiful except that they are.
So when you do your performance, how long does your performance take?
It's an hour long, and then there'll be an interval, and then there'll be a talk back, or a question and answer, with people, local environmentalists, or poets, or people who, you know, people we find, friends. We've asked Bill McKibben and Steve Kellett to be with us in our first performance up here in the Monsheim Museum of Science on April the 8th. We're going to have those two to be the talk back.
Excellent.
So that the talk back is for the audience to ask questions, because, you know, there will be obviously questions, and then everyone goes home with a copy of the book. So that's the format of the show.
Roger?
Darling?
Yes.
Okay. And so now I'd like to turn this over to Lisa Harrow and Roger Payne, who are going to give us a sample of lessons from Copernicus.
I'll start by talking about natural laws, which we have in the course of the performance built up to. Here we go. Natural laws are vitally important insights that scientists have given to society. Society needs to realize that the laws themselves are inherent truths and not matters for debate. That scientists didn't invent them. They simply discovered that they were there all along, unrecognized by us, but underlying everything. Natural laws include such simple truths as, 1, the lives of every species, including humans, depend directly or indirectly on the lives of other species. 2, to have a future, living things must live sustainably and only produce products that can be broken down into inert components or utilized by other organisms. 3, no species living in a closed system can continue to expand its population indefinitely. And just to be clear about this, although the Earth receives energy from the sun and debris from space, it is otherwise a closed system. For, in order to survive, all species require some degree of stability in their habitat. 5. All life, including human life, is a product of evolution and is therefore selfish by nature. Selfish behavior is an advantage to species until they dominate their closed system entirely and become plague species, whereupon selfishness becomes a fatal disadvantage. Always. There are lots of other natural laws, but just for the record, we who live in the developed world are currently out of step with all the ones I've just mentioned. Natural laws are brutally inflexible and have demonstrated their power by exerting absolute control over millions of species for billions of years. Our desire for things to run differently offers the same resistance to natural laws that a grape offers to a steamroller. In spite of this negativity, is a wonderfully positive way to look at our problems. Their sheer magnitude means that because so much is now at stake, that no generation before ours has ever faced an opportunity for such greatness. By acting, we can make our generation beloved above all others. By failing to act, we can make our generation vilified above all others. We need to choose between action and inaction.
The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps a better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Thank you. Lessons from Copernicus. You're beginning to head out into the world and perform this. You already have. Give people a sense of what's involved and then where they can perhaps see you in the future.
Well, what we're doing is we're doing it in a school down in Massachusetts in March, and then we're doing it in April in the Montreal Museum of Science up here in Vermont where we live on April the 8th. And then in May, we have some performances that we're still talking about over on the West Coast. And what I'm hoping is once we get the show locked it down, I mean, I'm speaking as an actor here, not as a scientist, because it's not a lecture, it is a show. Once we get it locked down and properly in its final entity stage, then it'll just start happening, popping up. We have all sorts of people who want us to do it for them. But I see us doing it in churches. I see us doing it at universities and high schools, anywhere where we can actually be heard and change people's hearts and minds, really. And I think, so it's something that obviously has a place with the environmental world, but I think I would love to take it across and, you know, do it in every small town in America, really. Also, the interesting thing is that the book, What Can I Do, is being published in Australia and New Zealand in October, and we're going to be doing it out there as, you know, for the book tour, because there's nothing I can read in the book. You know, book tours normally people read. There's nothing to read, so I thought we'd do the show. So, because it's not just America, it's humanity that really the show is speaking to. So, I just feel passionately that it will take on a life of its own as once we start doing it with confidence out there and we say, yep, this is it, this is the message is finely tuned, we've got it, let's go. It will start coming and then I'll build a website. It'll be, any performances will be on my website, whatcanidousa.org, until I've registered the site for the Copernicus Institute website. I just haven't started building it yet. That's how we're going to get around.
Fabulous. Roger, how about you? If people wish to learn more about the Voyage of the Odyssey, help us find out how.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, we're on PBS's website, so you go to pbs.org and then /Odyssey. O-D-Y-S-S-E-Y, just like the Iliad and the Odyssey. And that will give you, there are hundreds of little films. I do a thing which is called A Voice from the Sea. There's information about where the boat is and what it's finding out. There are little movies about what's being seen from the boat. There's all sorts of stuff that teachers, for example, can use. And because it's on that website and has been for about 4 years, it's being used now and starting to be used in classrooms all around the country, in fact, around the world.
And then also talk about Ocean Alliance.
Ocean Alliance is the organization that runs it, and there we have a website as well, Ocean Alliance, that's one word, oceanalliance.org. That will lead you to pbs.org, or pbs.org will lead you back to Ocean Alliance.
I've got a great big huge smile on my face as I think of both of you, and that's really the truth. What a wonderful moment this has been for me and for people who will have the opportunity to listen to the show. We started out with Lisa talking about what can I do with this practical, wonderful little book, An Alphabet for Living. We talked with Roger Payne about his work in the oceans, the voyage of the Odyssey as he travels, and he has 1 year left in his journeys. And then, as well, they're collaborating now on Lessons from Copernicus. What an amazing couple. You two are really primary examples of what is needed on the planet right now.
Thing was that Roger always said that he never agreed with C.P. Snow that there was a division between science and art. And it's so interesting, once you start becoming involved in a project like this, all kinds of everything you read points in the same direction. And now that everywhere I go, there is this great fusion happening between science and art, and it feels really wonderful to be part of something that, of course, to me, science is the most creative thing you can be. Because I believe all human beings are creative, and I think that if we do nothing else, if we can just awaken in the human spirit people's desire to actually be creative about the way we're living on this world, because people are not happy. Most people are not happy. And they have to just look at why. And it's not something that, you know, just religion alone will solve, or just buying a new car will solve. What solves it is actually beginning to realize that we can all help. And we are in one community, and we can just do our little bit. And each step towards a healthier future is the steps that we should be taking. And that feels good to me. And so I'm finding enormous happiness in being able to live more lightly on the earth. And that could be Pollyanna-ish, but it's also the truth. And I just wish to have other people understand that that's possible.
Roger, any final thoughts?
When I started the project of Lessons for Copernicus, I have to admit that I was deeply depressed. I just thought, oh my gosh, there's no hope. You know, things are so far out of control. I spent my life studying various aspects of them. I've listened to hundreds of lectures that most people don't, unfortunately, get a chance to hear, but which give you heaps, mounds, mountains of evidence that show what's going down the drain and so on. And then Lisa got to doing this book, and we began being steeped in all sorts of information about what various groups were doing all over the United States and in Europe and in other parts of the world. And the result was amazing. I suddenly began to think, my gosh, the information that we have scientifically is sufficient to be able to know where to start and what to do. The techniques to do various changes are actually quite straightforward. All that's lacking is the will, and that's all we need to adopt. And I think that's become, to me, a really important... It was the most hopeful possible result that I think I could have imagined from getting into a project like this. My reaction now is, hey, let's get on with it. What lies ahead is thrilling, as long as what we're working for is something that has behind it the scientific basis and makes sense. Then what we need to do is figure out how to interact with other people and people who don't have the same approach that we do. And that's where I think that the sort of approach just through art and poetry and so on can make a big difference.
Lisa Harrell, Roger Payne, thank you so much for joining me on the Wild Side News, and we look forward to continuing this and following your work through time.
Great, thanks, Sydney. And we'll let you know if there are any performances in your neck of the woods.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
You're right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
And you will come along on this ongoing quest for the voice of the earth each week on the Wild Side News. Next week, we go in depth with the Apollo Alliance.
Until then, or anytime on our archives, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios, peace, and power to the artists and warriors for life and wonder. Now go on out and make it happen.